Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN, the Independent Voter News. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests so you can develop your own more informed opinion. My guest today is Isaac Saul, an experienced reporter in the world of politics and the founder of Tangle. Tangle is an independent, ad-free, subscriber-supported newsletter that provides balanced insights into major political issues. Mr. Saul has an accomplished background. After college, he helped build A+, Ashton Kutcher's solutions journalism media outlet. His personal work has appeared in Time Magazine, Vox, the New York Daily News, the Huffington Post, and Independent Journal Review, among others. And he's been cited by media outlets such as Fox News, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. In 2016, Yahoo News named Mr. Saul as one of the 16 people whose writing shaped the 2016 election. And in 2020, Forbes magazine called him one of the 1,000 upstart entrepreneurs redefining the American dream. He joins me today to talk about Tangle and some of the issues he's taken on recently through that venue. Welcome to Deconstructed, Isaac.
Thank you so much for having me, TJ. I appreciate it.
Isaac, tell me about Tangle.
Sure. So Tangle News is a politics newsletter that summarizes the best arguments from the right and the left on the news of the day and then gives you my take. So basically, I started Tangle in 2019 because I realized that people are living in their own media bubbles. They are consuming media content that reinforces their political priors. This was kind of a novel idea back in 2013, 2014, when I first started thinking about this newsletter. But today it's something that most people, most American voters, I think know is that, you know, our social media is creating kind of echo chambers for us that we live in. And I have been seeking out a way to create a news organization that could be appreciated and supported and trusted by conservative voters, liberal voters, independent voters, people who are moderates or politically incongruent, like I like to say I am. My politics don't fit neatly into any box. And so I figured, why not start something where we just explicitly give arguments from across the political spectrum and let people try and make up their own mind about the big issues that are happening out there?
You have a unique format, which I very much appreciate when I took a look at Tangle. Can you walk the audience through that format?
Absolutely. The format is definitely our special sauce. There are a couple places that kind of do similar things, I think, but nobody that really does it quite like we do. So the first thing we do is we pick a main topic that we're going to cover in the newsletter every day. For instance, what the United States should do with regards to Ukraine, specifically whether we should impose a no-fly zone in Ukraine and how our own energy independence can move forward in a way that decouples us from Russia. And so we take that main issue and we give readers just kind of the most neutral, fact-based breakdown of what's going on around that issue. So what are people saying? Why is it important? Why are people debating it? What's some of the most recent news related to it? And then we say, now we're going to give you some views from the left and then the right and then my take. And so the next part of the newsletter is we directly quote and summarize three opinion pieces or editorials from conservative or right-leaning media outlets or writers, and then three opinion pieces from liberal or left-leaning media outlets or editorial boards. And that way you're getting six different opinions from all across the political spectrum that are from people who are trusted, well-established writers, or sometimes people who are maybe less well-known, but their writing about this specific issue has gotten a lot of attention. And we try and include the kind of independent, libertarian, center-right view in the conservative section, as well as the more traditional Republican view, and then the more Trump-ish, populist, right-wing view. So you'll see everybody from Tucker Carlson to the Wall Street Journal to the National Review to Reason.com in that section. And then on the left, we try and give you the same breadth of that sort of center-left, more Biden, establishment Democrat type attitude. And then maybe you're more progressive left from, you know, a news outlet like The Nation or Vox or something like that. And then somewhere that's maybe a little offbeat left-wing political view that is maybe socialist light, something like that. And that way, again, you're getting this really, really wide spectrum of views and opinions that you can sort of suss out. And then after all that, I tell you what I think as a political journalist, as somebody who has experience interviewing politicians and reading about the news and talking about media bias. I just try and tell you, not totally convince you about what the right view is. I'm not trying to tell people how to think. I'm just telling people how I think what I'm seeing in these issues that maybe other people aren't talking about. And most newsletters include some reader feedback, people criticizing my point of view. We also have a reader question, and we do a roundup of some really interesting numbers that are out there in the news. And then we usually end every newsletter with a have a nice day section, just a little feel good, good news story to wash everything down, because I know that the news can be kind of a stressful and anxiety inducing place sometimes. But, you know, it should take you about 10 or 12 minutes to read. And when you're done, you will have, in my view, basically the most holistic view you can get on one news item of the day from one single source. And you don't have to go read a million other news outlets just to try and get some semblance of balance or honesty from the news that you're consuming.
You also do something that is quite unique. When you get something wrong, where do you correct it?
I correct it at the top of the newsletter. It will be the first thing you see if I screw up. And I also track the number of corrections that we have in the newsletter. So if I made a mistake in today's newsletter, then tomorrow when you open the newsletter, the very first thing you'll see is a banner that says correction. And then I will tell you how the error was made, what the mistake was, whether it was me really not knowing something, or if I copy and pasted something wrong or misread something, or an editor changed something that I wrote and they were wrong. And then I'll tell you how many corrections we've had in the newsletter total all time. And I'll tell you when the last correction was that we issued before this current one, which is sort of my way of trying to embrace some transparency and intellectual humility and not do what a lot of other news organizations do, which is bury a correction at the bottom of an article or just ghost change an article without updating their readers that the initial thing they wrote was incorrect or misleading or inaccurate. And to be totally frank with you, when I decided to do that, it was a scary proposition because I'm an experienced reporter. I knew I was going to screw up. Mistakes happen. Everybody's human. And I was worried that I was going to make so many mistakes that it would kind of bog the newsletter down. But people have received it so positively and been so encouraging about it anytime I'd screw up just for owning it, that it's sort of reinforced the behavior for me and made me realize how much it earns people's trust to know that I'll be really transparent and honest with you when I make a mistake.
Yeah, Isaac, I got to tell you, I was shocked when I saw it because you were transparent and you actually took responsibility. And I don't know when the last time I saw that among traditional type journalism. You wrote an article a few months ago on media bias that caught my attention, and it echoed things that I've been saying since around 2012. How would you describe the current media ecosystem?
It's a great question. So now I would describe it as being broken. I think it's fundamentally broken. I think, you know, like I said, kind of at the top of the show, a lot of people are consuming political news that reinforces their prior beliefs. But I also think that the forces that are driving what's wrong with our current media ecosystem are kind of insidious and not as obvious as a lot of people think. I think the most common criticism about the media is that it's generally too liberal or it's out of touch. And I think there are absolutely things that are true about those criticisms. I'm not saying that those things aren't true, but I do think that those powers are kind of less important than some of the other things that happen in the media and are not the number one reasons why I created Tangle and why I thought Tangle was so important. So a lot of the stuff I talk about in that article are things like hiring bias, which is the kinds of people that get jobs at major media outlets. It's about how the initial liberal bias of the media has driven a really thriving and important conservative media ecosystem, but now has sort of divided the media into two, kind of one conservative, one liberal media side. It's about straight news versus opinion and how those lines have been blurred. So the ways that news outlets publish stuff and how they label certain articles and whether readers understand when they're getting news or when they're getting opinion. And it's also about bad incentives, people being driven mostly to get ad revenue by getting a lot of page views on stories, which means the more sensational and clickbaity a story is, the more likely they are to make a lot of money off of it, which creates a lot of really bad incentives. incentives. And then, of course, there's Donald Trump, who ushered in a whole era of kind of media hatred and open bias towards a political candidate. And then the sort of overcompensation that happened in the wake of Trump, which is media journalists generally trying to prove that they're not biased in ways that I think sometimes are deleterious for their work. And then there's a few other things I talk about, like the bubble that journalists live in and, you know, some reasons why I think maybe you should give journalists some of your trust, and then how Tangle tries to solve the issue mainly.
Excellent. Well, Isaac, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about media bias when we come back. Welcome back. My guest today is Isaac Saul, an experienced reporter on politics and the founder of Tangle, an independent newsletter and podcast that summarizes the best political arguments from the left, right, and center on current events. Isaac, you were mentioning some of the biases. How liberal is the media, if at all, and how does it compare to the media of 10 years ago?
It's a really good question. And, you know, I think I have argued in the past, actually, kind of as just a counterpoint to the sort of standard trope that the media has a liberal bias, that I actually don't believe today's media is as biased to the left as people say it is. And the reason I say that is not because I don't think the New York Times leans left. They quite obviously do, in my opinion. I say that because I think the media as a monolith is no longer just the major newspapers or news outlets that a lot of people traditionally think of. People now get their news from online news outlets, digital publications, YouTube channels, podcasts, radio shows, social media platforms, and now recently, increasingly, even private messaging apps where they're collecting news. And the reason this has happened is tenfold. Obviously, a lot of the conservative talk radio was sort of born out of a feeling that the kind of mainstream television network news was biased to the left. And then today, a lot of the sort of YouTube stars who are conservative and the podcast stars who are conservative are born out of the fact that some of the major newspapers they feel have gone left. But I actually believe there's kind of a growing balance that we're seeing now, because people who are these independent creators or have created their own sort of openly conservative right-wing media outlets now have a great deal of power and influence in the media space. One of the examples I give in the article is just that the New York Times is still the paper of record, and I still believe it's arguably the most important news organization in America because it drives a lot of the news and its journalism drives a lot of news commentary. But someone like Ben Shapiro, who's the founder of a conservative news outlet called The Daily Wire, is, in my opinion, far more influential than any single columnist at the New York Times. I mean, he has a huge platform. He has one of the top political podcasts in the country. He has millions of followers on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. And he runs an entire staff of conservative reporters who all report solely on issues that they think are going to kind of be red meat for their conservative audience, which I think is fine because those outlets are trying to bring balance to the space that they see as being predominantly left-wing. So the issue for me now is not that there's way more places to get your news that are liberal than there are places to get your news that are conservative. I actually don't think that's really true anymore, though it may have been true 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. What I do think is true is that any single news organization now is very likely to have an overt bias, either in terms of the language it uses when they're covering news stories, or in terms of just the story selection, or in terms of the types of reporters or people that they hire. All of these things sort of create this issue where any one person getting news from any one source is not really going to be getting typically an objective take on the news, in my opinion. And that means that people have to go to multiple places to get kind of a well-rounded look on the news, which is part of why I created Tangle, to sort of solve for that problem so you could get it all in one space rather than having to read a bunch of different news outlets from the right and from the left and maybe a couple sort of more neutral, centrist-ish news outlets to sort of get an idea of what actually is going on out there.
There really seem to be two different things happening. You've got the individual biases, and you're somewhat alluding to that, like confirmation bias, which is the tendency to seek out information that supports something that you've already been led to believe. at more of a business level, you have organizations that probably are playing upon the law of contrast, which suggests that the closer you place dissimilar ideas or items, the greater the contrast. So when you have political groups like Republicans and Democrats, they have to take the extremes because they know they're going to be running in parallel. And the more contrast they can create, the easier it is to separate people from their money and their votes. The business of media is almost the same thing because they've now seemed to have divided the pie, if you will, into a conservative and a liberal element. And they have to push the news in a way that contrasts it so that they can not only maintain their audience base, but expand it. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, I think that's a great sort of summation of some of the problems that exist out there. And one of the stories that I sort of made an example out of in this piece that I wrote about media bias was some of the coverage that I'd seen out there around the Freedom Convoy, the truckers who were cruising across Canada and showed up in Ottawa and sort of shut down the capital for a few days. So, you know, just as a bit of background, I think generally speaking, to journalists at least, and I think to a lot of news junkies, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, their straight news teams are sort of viewed as being the best of the best. If you're a New York Times journalist or a Wall Street Journal journalist, you are kind of at the top of the game. You're getting paid the most. The best reporters typically go there because they can make the most money and they have the most resources. And these two papers have huge distribution, really strong influence. Their reporting drives a lot of the commentary and punditry out there. So I sort of view them as sort of the left and the right-ish version of the two most important elements of the newspaper industry. And yet, when you read how they covered the Freedom Convoy, even though they are supposed to have the best journalists and editors on staff that you can really find in the planet, they cover it in distinctively different ways. They use different language, they frame the story differently, they have different sources. And the fact that the two of them can cover the same exact story and sort of frame it in very different ways, I think, is really telling. So one of the examples I gave was just the Times and the Journal both wrote explainer pieces about the Freedom Convoy, basically at a very fundamental level, trying to tell their readers exactly what was going on in Canada and who was involved in this thing. So I'll just give you a brief sort of summation of some of the language that they use in those stories. In the New York Times, the second paragraph of the story, the so-called nut graph, which is supposed to be in journalism, the paragraph that explains the context of a story, the Times immediately quoted Justin Trudeau, who they said was isolating after testing positive for the coronavirus and has sought to downplay the scope and influence of the protesters, calling them a small fringe minority and lashing out at them for desecrating war memorials, wielding Nazi symbols, spreading disinformation, and stealing food from the homeless during protests in Ottawa. So the New York Times makes a decision in the very beginning, the very top of their article, to quote Trudeau as framing all of the protesters as carrying Nazi symbols, stealing from the homeless during the protests, and spreading disinformation. So they've made an editorial choice that this is going to be the very first thing they tell their readers about these protests, which, even though this is a straight news story, in my opinion, is a very clear example of the kind of bias that the reporters and the editorial staff have and where they're trying to drive their readers in terms of the direction of the information that they want to have. And you can contrast that with the nut graph in the Wall Street Journal, which again is telling the exact same story. It's the exact same placement in the article. So again, this is the part of the article in journalism that's supposed to give readers some additional context about the story that they're about to hear. And the nut graph in the Journal says some of the vehicles are adorned with Canadian flags along signs and slogans demanding their rights under the country's constitution be restored. Among them, the right to decline to get vaccinated for COVID-19, and that rules be abolished requiring vaccination, either work, travel, or either the local pub. And the convoy was organized under the Freedom Convoy 2022 banner, and it has forced some businesses to close their doors and disrupted residents' daily lives. But tens of thousands of supporters have gathered near the country's parliament on consecutive weekends to show their support. So again, the Wall Street Journal now, the way that they're trying to push their readers is almost a polar opposite, despite the fact these are two straight straight news reports. We're not talking about opinion pieces here. We're talking about reporters, editors, a whole staff. And the language that the journal uses is about Canadian flags. It's about freedom. It's about constitution. It's about the right not to get vaccinated. It's about tens of thousands of supporters gathering. So you put those two up next to each other. And on one side, you have Nazis, disinformation, desecrating war memorials, small fringe minority. On the other side, you have Canadian flags, Constitution, Freedom Convoy, tens of thousands of supporters. And I said to my readers when I wrote this piece, I did not try and go out and pick an example that really illustrated this. I literally chose this example because it was the story we covered in Tangle the previous day. And I just knew I could pick any random story, both the Times and the Journal were covering, and illustrate this discrepancy and how exactly they cover it, the language they use, the framing they use. And this is the kind of media bias I'm talking about, which, again, I think is really insidious because it's a lot more subtle than, oh, our editorial board is always leaning left on issues or always supporting Democratic presidents, or our editorial board's always right on issues or always supporting Republican presidents. This is where people are going, the best newspapers in the world, where people are going to get allegedly objective, straightforward news out there. And yet, just by this example, you can see how different that information is and how differently stories are being framed for readers.
I thought that was an outstanding example of the frightening disparity with which the facts are treated anymore. Isaac, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about Tangle and media bias when we come back. Welcome back. My guest today is Isaac Saul, the founder of Tangle, an independent newsletter and podcast that summarizes the best political arguments from the left, right, and center on the critical issues that we're presented with on a political basis each day. Isaac, you had an interesting term in your article on media, and that was dreaded analysis. What did you mean by dreaded analysis?
Yes, the dreaded analysis. You know, I have a section in this media bias article where I sort of talk about the difference between opinion and news stories. And traditionally, there's a divide in news organizations where you have opinion writers and you have reporters. And reporters are supposed to go out and find a story, suss out the facts, tell you the main information and elements of the story, maybe get a few people quoted on the record about whatever they're covering. And then opinion pieces are where the truth and data and comments by people get to be leveraged a little bit in, I think, an openly partisan way. And readers are supposed to know that when they're reading the opinion section, they're getting the opinion. They're not there because they're trying to get some objective news report that's going to tell them all the facts and information and quotes and data and context that they need to know. They're going there to get an opinion. And recently, I've noticed what I referred to in this article as the dreaded analysis pieces, which is this sort of new weird hybrid mix of reporting and opinion piecing that I think is just now at this point, straight up opinion news being penned by traditional reporters and journalists. And the reason I say that is because when news outlets frame something or drop something under this banner as being analysis, it's supposed to sort of create this sense that you're reading an expert opinion or a reporter's opinion or a beat reporter's opinion about a certain issue. But what actually happens is that they create this sort of space and flexibility on the kinds of language that typically isn't permitted in a standard straight news report. And they get into things like conjecture and opinion making, and they can slant the piece in a way that's falls under this banner of quote unquote analysis, but lives in the news section, but is really just a subtle opinion piece. And so my guidance for readers in this media bias article is that if you see something that falls under this analysis banner, you should move forward reading it the same way you would if you were reading an opinion piece or a commentary piece or an editorial, because what you're actually reading is no different, in my opinion. There's a big distinction between news and analysis, and there's very little distinction between analysis and opinion writing, because most opinion writers are just giving their analysis of a certain issue. And again, this is not to bash that kind of writing. You know, I do editorial writing. I do opinion writing. I think it's important and it's good for Americans to have these debates and have these arguments and put all this stuff out there. I think it's bad for news organizations to put something under a banner like analysis that makes it sound very high-minded and expertise and neutral, when in reality, what they're doing is just concealing an editorial or opinion piece as a news hit, which it really isn't.
Earlier, you mentioned the former president, and you have something in your article that you call the Trump effect. What is the Trump effect, and what type of impact has that had on media?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the 2016 election specifically divorced media in a way and divided it in a way that we had really never seen before that election, mostly because Trump was viewed by so many kind of institutional thinkers as being such a huge threat and so dangerous that everybody felt as if they had to pick a side. He was viewed as this existential threat to reporters and opinion makers. And because he lied a lot, which he did, he told a lot of fibs and whoppers, we weren't really prepared. And when I say we, I mean the media weren't really prepared with how to cover him. We weren't prepared for how to cover somebody as bombastic as him. We weren't prepared on how to cover somebody who said the media is the enemy of the people or reporters are horrible and they're destroying America. And instead of responding in a really kind of neutral or detached or, I think, you know, a more professional type reporter way, a lot of reporters responded by openly loathing the president and feeling that they were justified in openly loathing him. And it created this really interesting dynamic, even among traditional conservatives, the quote unquote never Trump Republicans, where they drew their line in the sand and they said, I'll never be able to support this president. And everything he's going to do from now on is going to be judged under this banner of my perspective on him as being a totally unacceptable political candidate. And in the wake of Trump, he both divided the media. He also obviously, I mean, I think the country had all of its divisions before Trump came along, but he exasperated some of them in a way where a lot of Americans started to say, okay, if this writer, this reporter has been openly critical of the president, then they're just biased and they don't like Trump and I won't trust them. And so they only started following or supporting the reporters and writers who were supportive of Trump. And the same thing happened on the left, where liberals and Democrats hated Trump so much that any reporter who ever uttered a kind word about him or gave him credit or even just gave him attention became a huge pariah. I mean, one of the big examples is Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, who is an access journalist. She has a lot of rapport with the president. She's writing a book about him that I think actually just came out. She did a ton of interviews with him. And I mean, I don't know Maggie Haberman personally. From reading her work and understanding her body of work, I could say pretty definitively that she's not a conservative. I think she's definitely left of center in her politics. And yet she became hated by the left. If you read the mentions of any tweet, any news article she sends out, she is like one of the enemy number ones because she gave Trump so much attention and because she would sometimes write stories about positive things he was doing when he was in the White House. And so this Trump effect that I talk about is this paradigm shift where everybody just sort of took a side and then readers took their sides and the cycle goes on. And Trump says he hates reporters and reporters say they hate Trump. And there was nobody left who was really viewed as a centrist or down the middle reporter because everybody had to be either deemed pro-Trump or anti-Trump. And I think we're still seeing the impacts of that today in a lot of ways.
If the media overcompensated for Trump, and while he remains newsworthy, I suppose you would say at this point in time, what's your prognosis for recovery from that overcompensation? Very quickly, do you think the media is going to move back to where it was, or do you think it's shifted that bar for the foreseeable future?
It's a really tough question, and I don't know what the future holds for a lot of the reporters who sort of showed their hands in the Trump years. I think one of the big issues that I see and this overcompensation I talk about is that a lot of reporters in the wake of the 2016 election responded to Trump being elected, something so many people did not think was possible, not to take a victory lap, but I certainly did. I recognized in 2016 that he had a very good chance of winning, and I never thought Hillary Clinton was a great candidate. And because so many reporters didn't feel that way, they were so shocked by it. He was such a shock to the system that they responded by instead of living in their kind of liberal urban enclaves in New York City or Washington, D.C. or wherever else, that they were going to go out to the diners and go out to rural Arkansas or Montana and go to these 90% support Trump counties in America and try and get a view of what those people thought. And over the next 4 or 5 years, it created this really dangerous, in my opinion, polarization where the only stories we were seeing in America were kind of the Blue Lives Matter, super hard Trump supporting folks in Western Pennsylvania at a diner, or the people that reporters were interviewing on the streets in Brooklyn and New York or wherever, that's some liberal bastion. And the result is that the kind of 90% of America or 80% of America that's somewhere in between those two places gets very little airtime in the media. It creates the impression that we're all way more divided than we are. And it gives a less of a voice to more moderate, down-to-earth, less polarized, less really partisan Americans that are sort of trying to navigate the news and this new political dichotomy, who are very rarely seen in the news or talked about.
Isaac, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you, your articles, and Tangle?
So the best place to do it is to go to readtangle.com, R-E-A-D, Tangle, T-A-N-G-L-E.com. That is my baby. It's this newsletter I've created. We have a community of 30-some thousand daily readers. And if you go to readtangle.com, you'll get a little overlay that pops up on your screen and asks for your email address. And if you drop your email in there, I can start writing you newsletters. You'll get them Monday through Thursday, totally 100% free. And if you decide to become a paying subscriber, you can get our Friday editions and special editions. And you also support our work doing independent journalism. That is the number one place to find me. I am my worst self in platforms like Twitter and on social media, so don't even bother. Just go to readtangle.com and you'll get the best version of me and our stories and a really holistic look at the news, which I don't think you can get in a lot of places today.
Isaac Saul, you're a champion of serious journalism, just when we thought that phrase had become an oxymoron. I hope everyone will check out Tangle and recommend it to others who might be looking for a fresh perspective. Isaac, I wish you continued success, and thank you again for joining me on Deconstructed.
Thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.